Good morning.
Good morning.
Every time I'm in San Antonio, I feel more Texan for some reason. You know, I thought I was a Texan when I was in Houston, but when I'm in San Antonio, I'm like, this is the heart of Texas for me. And also the weather here is just beautiful. 97 degrees outside. Can't beat that. My name is Mark Omar. I am a missionary priest, and I'm moving to Panama, where the weather won't be any different. So I need you all to pray for me. My sermon today is titled Serious Discourses. It's the first chapter in Galatians. We've already read it, so I'm not going to read it again, but I'm going to go and dive right in. This is a very, very hard letter, and I have felt convicted as I was studying this that we need to do better as Christians for the gospel of Christ. So the theme is Christ's death has brought in the age of the new covenant. People do not have to become Jews or follow the outward ceremonies of the Mosaic law in order to be Christians. To require a work-based salvation denies the heart of the gospel, which is justification by faith alone and not by keeping the works of the law. What we can see immediately in this first chapter of Galatians and at the end of verse 9 in particular is if anyone is preaching to you a gospel contrary to the one you received, let him be accursed, anathema, damned, be it man or angel. This is a curse he calls upon. This letter deals with matters on which your eternal destiny hangs. If anyone brings you another gospel, let him be damned. With these statements, the Christian faith stands and falls. The truth that underlies Galatians 1 is that there's only one gospel. So a little bit of the background. A crisis had hit the churches in Galatia. The church came into being as a result of God's Spirit at work in Paul's proclamation of the gospel. But within a short space of time, since Paul left, the church was infiltrated by false prophets, false teachers, also known as Judaizer. Paul refers to them as those who trouble you. In verse 7, they added the burden of circumcision and a return to works-based salvation. Growing up out of this truth, there's three statements I want to show you that are very crucial for us to hear and to believe. Because nothing has happened to change these three statements since the time of Paul. Number one, it is astonishing when a person hears and believes the gospel, but afterward turns away from it. Galatians chapter 1, verse 6 to 7. Number two, if a person rejects the gospel, he stands under God's curse, whether he is an angel or a man. That's a promise. Number three, the servant of the gospel seeks to please God alone and not man. We're not called to please men. We're called to please God alone. So the text does not define the gospel. The rest of the book does. So our focus today will not be on the content of the gospel, but on its cruciality. First of all, the underlying truth of the passage. There is only one gospel. In verse 6, Paul says that the Galatians are starting to turn away to a different gospel. Then in verse 7, he corrects a false impression. He did not mean to say that there are several possible gospels and that they have simply chosen another one of the several options. In verse 7, he carefully says, not that there is another gospel, but there are some who trouble you and want to pervert the gospel. This verse is clear. There is no other gospel than the one that he preached to them and which they received. To be sure, as verse 6 and 7 make plain, there are people presenting ideas as the gospel, but these are perversions and distortions. The implication of this text for our day are very important. The text is a radical, forthright denial of pluralism. I can never say that. Pluralism. which says that we are all different on different roads to heaven, but our destination is the same. You've heard the old, all roads lead to Rome, because you know, Romans built all the roads to lead to Rome. It's not like that with our gospel. But our destination is the same. That's what they're saying. They're popular forms of this universalism, and they're technical scholarly forms of it. But there's no biblical universalism. That is, no biblical teaching that a person can go on rejecting the gospel of Christ and still be saved. There are other religions besides Christianity. There are other leaders besides Christ. But there's no other gospel. There's no other good news. And there's no other salvation. And what makes that underlying truth in the text so powerful is that the different gospel in churches of Galatia was not a religion from a foreign land. It was a close counterfeit to the real thing. Just a little bit. Just mixed it, one small little lie, just kind of shifted a little bit. In today's world, we have several major Christian heresies. You know what the first major Christian heresy was? Can you guess? Islam. Islam is a Christian heresy. Okay? It just shifted just a little bit. And I'm familiar with Islam because I was raised by a Muslim father who, by the grace of God, became a Christian before he died. Islam just kind of shifts things. Well, yes, he's our prophet too. He's Jesus. You know, his mother is Mary. He was actually born of a Virgin Mary. He's actually coming back again, but he's not the Son of God. Another Christian heresy, okay? Mormonism. And what's common between Islam and Mormonism is that they were both a counterfeit gospel presented to them by a false angel, okay? Muhammad claimed that Gabriel gave him the gospel, or the new gospel, in a cave. And people believed him because he didn't know how to read and write. He came back with all these poems. And Joseph Smith was visited by Moroni. And those are false gospels. Another one, the Watchtower Society, their false view of Jesus and of his deity, and that he was created by the Father and was an angel. Another Christian heresy, prosperity gospel. All your problems will go away if you follow Jesus. Your wife will be able to bear children. Your goats will multiply. Your bank account will be great. Just send me $20. That's another false gospel. The people in verse 7 were perverting the gospel, were professing Christians. They probably belonged to the church in Jerusalem and knew its leaders. This different gospel was not on the order of Buddhism or Hinduism or Islam. It was an in-house distortion. It was promoted by men who called themselves Christian brothers. See Galatians chapter 2, verse 4. So another implication of verse 6 and 7 for us is that doctrinal maturity is not a luxury. Doctrinal maturity is not a luxury. It is a necessity. You need to know your Bible. You need to know your doctrine. If a different gospel, which is no gospel but only a perversion, can spring up inside the church, then surely we must make it our aim to become rigorous and discriminating in our doctrinal knowledge. Paul said in 1 Corinthians chapter 14, verse 20, "Brethren, do not be children in your thinking, but be babes in evil, but in thinking be mature." Galatians, this book, is the hand grenade of the Bible. It is explosive. And Brother Paul is angry. Galatians is one of the best books in the Bible for helping us refine and clarify what the heart of the gospel is, which can't be replaced or altered. There's a tragic pattern in churches and in history. I think renewal breaks forth on a church or an age through a fresh encounter with the gospel and the Spirit. Hearts are filled with the love of Christ, and mouths are filled with praise. The concern for evangelism and justice arises. But in all the glorious stirrings of the heart, there begins to be an impatience with doctrinal refinement. Clear doctrine requires thought, and thought is seen to be the enemy of feeling, so it is resisted. There is the widespread sense that the Holy Spirit will guard the church from all errors, and so rigorous study and thought about the gospel are felt to not only be a threat to joy, but a failure of faith. The result over a generation is the emergence of a people whose understanding of biblical teaching is so hazy and imprecise that they are sitting ducks for the Galatian heresy. I'm very saddened when I look at young people today and see what they think about sexuality, what they think about abortion. People who've grown up in the church, what they think about justice. Because we've relaxed ourselves. We're not teaching doctrine to our children. It arises right in their midst, Paul said to the elders of Ephesus in Acts chapter 20, verse 30. From among your own selves will arise men speaking distorted things to draw away the disciples after them. He says in verse 27 that he has done his part to prepare them by declaring the whole counsel of God. I hope to be able to say the same thing someday about my ministry. I did not shrink from declaring the whole counsel of God. So the underlying truth of the passage of Galatians, of this passage in Galatians, is that there is no other gospel. And the two implications is we need to hear from that are that universalism is wrong, and there are not many roads to heaven, but only one. And that rigorous attention to doctrinal clarity and faithfulness is crucial in the long run of the church life. Number one. To turn away is astonishing. The first of three statements that now grow up out of this underlying truth is that it is astonishing when a person first believes the true gospel and then turns away from it. Verse 6, Paul says, I am astonished that you're so quickly deserting him who called you in the grace of Christ and turning to a different gospel. In this verse, there are two reasons implied why turning to a different gospel is so astonishing. First, it is a turning from a calling God. You are deserting him who called you. You're not just turning from a doctrine or an idea. Don't fall prey to the notion that a concern for doctrine is impersonal. The gospel is a very personal good news of God's call to you. If you turn to a different gospel, you turn away from God. And that is astonishing. The second reason turning to a different gospel is astonishing is that it is a turning away from grace. Galatians 5:4, Paul describes what is happening like this. You're severed from Christ. You who would be justified by the law, you have fallen away from grace. Paul is simply stunned that so soon after his beautiful portrayal of Christ crucified for their sin, they would begin to turn to another gospel. He says, he's mad. He says in verse 3, Chapter 3, verse 1, oh, foolish Galatians, who has bewitched you? You know, if you turn away from the gospel, it's like sorcery has happened to you. It's like a spell was cast on you. You, before whose eyes Jesus Christ was publicly portrayed as crucified, you can picture Paul back in Antioch listening in stunned silence to the report, shaking his head. To the churches of Galatia are turning away from God, from the grace, as he puts his head in his hands and wonders if his work was in vain. It was astonishing then, it is astonishing today, that anyone hearing the best news in all the world, God offers you full, free forgiveness and hope. That's the best news you could ever hear. We'll turn to a different gospel, which is no gospel at all. Two, to turn away brings God's curse. The second statement that grows out of the underlying truth is that there is no other gospel, is that rejection of the gospel leaves a person under God's curse. Even if we or an angel from heaven should preach to you the gospel contrary to that which we preach to you, let him be damned, accursed. As we have said before, so now I say again, if anyone is preaching to you a gospel contrary to that which he received, let him be accursed. The word is repeated here is anathema, accursed. When a person is anathema, he's cut off from Christ. Romans chapter 9, verse 3. And doomed to eternal punishment. 2 Thessalonians 1:9, Paul says that those who don't obey the gospel of our Lord shall suffer the punishment of eternal destruction and exclusion from the presence of the Lord and from the glory of his might. Have you noticed that preachers don't preach about hell anymore? They've softened that. They don't preach about hell. When a person rejects the gospel, the free gracious gift of God, forgiveness and kingship, then he remains under the divine curse for his sin, a terrifying prospect because of it is torment, its unending length. The reason I say this, curse abides on anyone who rejects the gospel and not on the false teachers in these verses, is that Paul uses the same word in 1 Corinthians 16:22. If anyone does not love the Lord, let him be accursed. Let him be damned. Paul does not have cotton candy concern for the gospel. He does not offer sugary smiles in controversy and say, to each his own. For Paul, the gospel of Christ is the point at which the awesome life of God touches the life of this foul world of sin. Satan does his best with television and radio to create in us a mind that is so trivial and banal and petty and earthly that we find ourselves incapable of feeling what terrifying truth in this world, this word anathema is. And how we need to guard ourselves from the barrage of eternity-denying entertainment. The Bible does not reveal to us the eternal curse of God that we may yawn and turn the page. The wrath of God is revealed to shake unbelievers. It shook me when I read this passage. To shake us out of our stupor. To take the swagger out of the Christian's walk and the cocky twang out of his voice. I borrowed that one. Seeking to please God. Number three, seeking to please God, not man. Finally, the third statement that grows out of the underlying truth is one gospel. Scott, you said we could be here till four?
Yeah.
Okay. I'm almost done.
I'd agree with you.
Is that the servant of the gospel seeks to please God alone and not man? Am I now seeking to the favor of men or God, or am I trying to please men? If I was still trying to please men, I should not be a servant of Christ. Verses 8 and 9, Paul had just said something that will not win him many friends. It doesn't please most people to hear someone pronounce the sentence of eternal damnation. And so what Paul does in verse 10 is give an account of why he's willing to talk this way. He's willing to talk this way because pleasing people is much lower on list of priority than serving Christ. Two things are at stake when the gospel is perverted. One is the glory of Christ. The other is the salvation of the sinner. If the gospel is twisted, the all-sufficiency of Christ's work is dishonored, and the way to salvation for sinners is blocked. Therefore, in order to serve Christ, to advance his glory, and achieve his saving purpose, we must oppose the perversion of the gospel with all our might. And whether it pleases people or not, brothers and sisters, this is why we are called to be unshaken witnesses of the gospel. I'm going to tell you a little bit about my testimony, and then we'll close in prayer and my vision. I had a Christian mother who was married to a Muslim father. She got serious after I was born with her faith. And she did not give up on her husband and on me, and she preached the gospel day in and day out. And she was charismatic. And you know, when those people start praying, man, they scream at you. They scream at you so hard. So, like, I wanted to do my own thing anyways. And my dad was like, you know, all roads lead to Rome. He was more of a, like, a kind of French, like, you know, what do you call him? A humanist, you know? Yeah, you know, I'm Muslim by name, whatever. So one day, it happened that some of my mom's family members were involved in witchcraft. They had gone to see a witch doctor and things like that. So
when my mom started preaching the gospel to them, they got shook up. The demons got shook up. And so what happened is that I witnessed the power of Jesus Christ. I saw these demons cast out of my family members. And so that's when I saw the power of Christ. And I was like, Lord, I need you. So I was scared out of hell. Okay. And then later, my dad became a Christian. And of course, I got the call. I received the call to become a pastor. Came here, did my studies and all that. And now I'm ready to go to Panama. Panama is a beautiful country. It's got a lot of distorted gospel. Roman Catholic Church there is just pretty much not teaching anymore the gospel. The prosperity gospel is there. So that's why I'm going to Panama. There's a mission. I want to plant a church that looks like this one. I love this church. Pray for me. It's very hard. I've been spiritually attacked. My wife will tell you that. It's been very hard. But thank you so much for having me. God bless you.
Thank you.